Now, a return visit to Howard County General Hospital in Columbia, Maryland. All year, we've been bouncing the Washington healthcare debate off people in that county. Doctors, patients, administrators, employers, and insurance brokers in the Baltimore suburb have been our sounding board. The other day, after the House had approved its version of a healthcare bill, I sat down with two people we heard from earlier this year. First, the CEO of the hospital, Vic Broccolino. For him, the measure of the healthcare problem is a crowded emergency room, people going to his hospital instead of to doctors. The prospect of a public insurance plan, which is so controversial in the Senate, strikes him as no problem.
For hospitals, a public option, provided it helps get us to the point where everyone is insured, is a good thing. We obviously like the idea that people are insured, will come to the hospital. We won't have to worry as much as we do now about bad debt and charity care. I think that if the public option, however, ends up costing too much money and people, meaning businesses, end up dropping coverage because of that, and they feel that it's better perhaps to pay the penalty rather than provide the coverage, that is not a good thing for the general public.
If the public option were to be very expensive, you're
yes,
saying that
that's
could be
correct,
a problem.
If it were expensive.
I thought the insurance brokers were concerned that it could be very cheap, that it would undersell private insurance policies.
Well, if that's the case, then they will not be offering, in my mind, adequate coverage. Adequate coverage to me doesn't begin with hospital insurance or hospital coverage. It begins with primary care coverage. Because you can have everyone insured, but if no one has a physician to take care of them, the people end up in the hospital's emergency department anyway.
A big criticism of the bill, or a criticism of another sort, is that it would spread coverage to many millions of people who don't have health insurance. But it doesn't address the other problem we have, which is that as a country we spend too much money on health care. Do you see any cost saving in the way we practice medicine in what's happening on Capitol Hill?
Well, if they can incorporate provisions in the final bill that actually penalize people for repeat admissions, people meaning physicians and hospitals, for unnecessary repeat admissions, for inappropriate care, for not using evidence-based practice, for not coordinating the care between primary care physicians and specialists, then I think there would be some hope for savings.
Mr. Broccolino, thank you very much for talking with us once again.
Thank you. Always good to see you.
Vic Broccolino is the president and CEO of Howard County General Hospital. Mark Appelstein is a urologist, and he's president of the hospital's professional staff. The public option doesn't faze Dr. Appelstein either. He says public plans typically have lower overheads than private insurers. And like many physicians, what makes all these pills bitter and otherwise easier to swallow for Mark Appelstein is Washington's plan to avert scheduled reductions in Medicare reimbursements. Dr. Appelstein says those cuts in Medicare rates would threaten the livelihoods of many doctors.
There's been some reports that Medicare reimbursement rates only cover approximately 65% of the office overhead. So one could then say every time you see a Medicare patient, you're losing 35%.
So explain this apparent contradiction, which is there's an interest in the entire effort to overhaul healthcare, to bend the curve of healthcare expenditure, to get down this $2 or $3 trillion a year that we spend on healthcare. But then we get to a nitty-gritty issue like, what do doctors get paid for their treatment of a huge number of Americans on Medicare? And the answer is, we got to spend more.
It's a challenge.
It may be a euphemism, Dr. Appelstein.
Yes, there is certainly within the system waste and, unfortunately, fraud. I do not think, though, that physicians intentionally either waste healthcare dollars or commit fraud. But there are parts of the document that address those issues specifically, and perhaps with new systems in place that will save some healthcare dollars.
You told me when I spoke to you first time that you'd been at a urologist convention in Chicago and somebody mentioned single-payer plan, something that hasn't been on the table in this entire discussion, and a huge number of urologists said, bring it on. It wasn't a wacky idea as far as your fellow urologists were concerned.
I think it's still a good idea. It would certainly eliminate a lot of paperwork. Part of the document that the House put forward, there's a line item in there that says that this bill will reduce the paperwork and make it easier to submit claims and to track care et cetera, et cetera. What's interesting is that the bill itself is over 1,900 pages, which is longer than War and Peace or the King James Bible.
I think that was not done in the spirit of reducing paperwork, writing a 1,900-page bill.
Well, it's pretty difficult to get through. So it's sort of like trying to save money but increase reimbursements. It's a challenge.
Dr. Appelstein, thank you very much for talking with us once again.
Thank you for having me back.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. There comes a time in the life of every commentator when choosing a topic to comment on must be shared with a spouse. For Andrei Codrescu, that time has come.
"I've got to say something," I said to Laura. "What should I say? How should I know?" she said. I said, "Something that will interest a lot of people, not just us. Maybe I should write about global warming," I proclaimed. "Maybe you should write about bulb dimming," she said. She had a point there. Bulbs have been dimming, and I'm not talking about flower bulbs. It's more like time has been going around putting out lights. When you're 20, you think the future's so bright, it's like that song, "You're immortal and you need sunglasses." When you're 30, you look to make a living, maybe establish a family, and it's a mellow light out there, full of summertime possibilities. And when you're 40, you're squinting a bit because you're not making enough money, you can't pay for your kids' school, your family isn't all that you're hoping for, you're commuting on a dingy highway instead of drinking martinis on the beach. At 50, you might be content to watch TV in the chiaro oscuro, if you're reasonably certain the kids aren't ODing and your wife is really at the hairdresser's, or you might be managing a motel on the interstate for room and board and writing your memoirs, blaming your parents for everything. At 60, you're looking forward to retiring and getting to that martini beach, or, if you just got fired, drinking from a paper bag under a streetlight. In any case, whether you've climbed into that neon sunset or are watching the changing traffic lights from under a bridge, the light's gotten a lot dimmer since you first saw that sunrise at 20 after staying up all night. Plus, your kids never call, and your parents can't remember who you are. "And how is this dim scenario going to interest anybody?" said Laura. "Don't you think everybody's been feeling dim all on their own? Thank you very much." "Well, that's the point," I brightened for a minute. "Everybody talks about global warming, but what they really worry about is bulb dimming." "You have something there," she said, flipping the channel.
Andrei Codrescu is the editor of Exquisite Corpse, a literary journal, online at corpse.org.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, the recession forces the closure of another family of small newspapers, including the pioneering gay paper, The Washington Blade. We'll hear more about these publications and what it means, not just to gay readers, but to all people who care about diverse voices in the news. We'll have that conversation in a moment. But first, earlier in the program, we talked about a new film that discusses the life and career of the crusading lawyer William Kunstler. During his decades-long career, he took on the defense of protesters, accused rapists, and alleged terrorists when he believed their rights or a critical principle of our justice system was at stake. But today, do attorneys still have a place at the forefront of the fight for social justice? Paul Butler believes they do. He's a professor of law at George Washington University and the author of the new book, Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. And he joins us now in our Washington, D.C. studio. Welcome. Thank you for coming.
Hey, Michelle. Great to be here.
So what is a hip-hop theory of justice?
Hip-hop is doing this ground-level reporting on how criminal justice system really works. And it's created by the people who know the system best. African-American young men are the most incarcerated group of people in the history of the world. So they're telling us how trials work, whether the police are fair, about prosecutors and defense attorneys, and they're doing it in tracks that you can dance to. It's really an amazing moment in pop culture history.
Is there a track or something you would direct us to? Because I have to tell you, I was watching videos just the other night, and I saw a lot of guys rolling around in dollar bills and putting on jewelry. I didn't hear a lot about the criminal justice system.
You see the police ever present. There can be the sweetest, sappiest hip-hop song. I'm thinking about this song this summer called Kiss Me on the Phone, about a boy saying goodbye to his girlfriend. And the police are there. They're everywhere in hip-hop. You know, you can watch all these sitcoms, read all these books about vampires. You can go to listen to country music. You'd never know that there are 2.5 million people in prison. You can't listen to urban radio more than 20 minutes without being reminded of that fact.
You know, you wrote a piece for the progressive magazine The Nation, which is tied to your book. It's titled 10 Things You Can Do to Reduce Incarceration. Among the things you recommend that people do is listen to hip hop. But I'm still not seeing the connection between listening to hip hop and reducing incarceration. Why? Why do you recommend it?
Because not only do these people come from communities where they're most likely to be accused of crime, they also come from communities where they're most likely to be victims of crime. And so, you know, some of these people are scared to death. And again, they're telling us about that when we listen to their music. They're telling us about ways that we can be safer and more free. The problem they're describing with criminal justice now is it just doesn't work.
And I want to talk more about some of the things that you recommend. You were once a federal prosecutor, so I don't think it'll surprise many people that among the other things you encourage people to do is do your jury duty. Why is that important?
Because jurors have all this power. I was a prosecutor in D.C., and I was told when I was a rookie that sometimes in criminal cases with drug possession especially, we persuade the jurors beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was guilty, and they would still find him not guilty. And these were mostly African-American jurors. And the reason was because they didn't want to send another black man to jail. And when I started trying cases, I found that to be exactly the case. It's called jury nullification. It's perfectly legal. It's a strategy that's been used to get rid of laws like the slavery law. It's worked. So in the book, I suggest a strategic way. I call for these Martin Luther King jurors to selectively nullify, to protest this war on drugs.
It's an interesting point because there are other ways in which you essentially urge people as a matter of conscience not to participate with the police. Just say no to the police. Don't be a professional snitch. You say don't accept money for cooperating with the police. But you also say, as you just mentioned, if you're a juror in a nonviolent drug case, vote not guilty. And there are critics who've taken issue with it. They're maybe very sympathetic with your desire to see fewer black men, particularly and black people in general, incarcerated because of the destructive effect on communities. But they also make the point of, who are you to say that that's a nonviolent crime? If you have people in some communities, there have been stories about people, you know, firebombing people's houses just because they ask drug dealers to move from their front porch. I mean, so who are you to say that's a nonviolent crime?
What I'm interested in, Michelle, is something that works. And things are getting worse, not better. There are more people locked up now than there were in like the 90s when you and I started talking about this stuff. And drugs are ever present. So what I'm looking for is a way to really get the dope boys off the street corners. That's what makes people feel unsafe. And we got better ways to do that than locking up everybody, because the result in places like D.C. and Baltimore is that about half of the young black men in their 20s have a criminal case.
You know, you're saying that things are getting worse and not better. It is true that the United States has one of the highest incarceration rates in the world and the highest according to peer economies. If you look at places in Europe with similar economies and sort of social structures, democratic governments and so forth. On the other hand, the level of violence in most places around the country is far lower than it was. The murder rate is far lower than it was even 10 years ago. Even in D.C., the murder rate is lower than it was 10 years ago. In New York and Washington, the homicide rate is on track to be the lowest it's been in 30 years. So how can you say it's getting worse?
Well, New York has actually reduced the prison population and at the same time reduced its crime rate. It turns out that there's this tipping point with locking people up, where when too many people are locked up, that actually increases crime. So in jurisdictions that have safely reduced the prison population, they've seen their crime rate go down. So we got to be strategic about this. It's about being smart on crime rather than just this tough on crime nonsense.
Talk to me a little bit more, if you would, in the couple of minutes that we have left about why you feel incarceration is so bad. And what exactly about incarceration, in your view, makes it so destructive that you have to take what I think some people would say extreme steps in order to stop the rate of increase?
Mm-hmm. So just to be clear, I'm not against all incarceration. So if you're going to rob, rape, murder, then yeah, you ought to be locked up for the protection of society. My concern is how we're using it for nonviolent offenders. Again, 500,000 people are actually locked up for committing a nonviolent drug offense. And that's way too many. If it actually got the dope boys off the street corner, maybe I'd support it. But it doesn't do that. What we're doing is disrupting families. You know, about half of the men and way more than half of the women who are in prison have children. And if they're in prison, that puts their kids at risk for going to prison. And again, so many people in some communities are locked up that getting locked up is a rite of passage. And in hip hop, it's called catching a case. It's kind of like catching the flu, a little bit your fault, a little bit the luck of the draw. And so the criminal law, in my scholarly language, is losing its deterrent effect. People don't have respect for the system anymore. We've got to make the system more respectable. And we can do that by being more strategic about who we lock up.
Do you think these ideas are gaining traction? I guess what I'm asking you is, do you think that anybody's listening outside of the people who listen to hip-hop?
Absolutely. So this isn't at all a geeky legal book. I wrote this for people who watch TV shows like CSI or The Wire. So this is the nonfiction version of that. I'm talking about the evolution of street knowledge. And the message is getting out. So President Obama has said that it's blind and counterproductive to lock up nonviolent drug offenders. He's called the war on drugs a failure. That's his word, not mine. So now we got to ask him to put some action behind that rhetoric. And so, you know, I think Attorney General Eric Holder has been very encouraging on these issues. We just got to get everybody to understand it's a priority. Again, it's not about coddling criminals. It's about being smart on crime so that we can all be safer and more free.
Paul Butler is a professor at George Washington University Law School. His new book is Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. He joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studio. If you want to read the article in The Nation that we've also been talking about, we'll have a link on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Programs, and then on Tell Me More. Paul Butler, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. In Los Angeles, the UCLA campus looked like a scene from the 60s today. The University of California's Board of Regents met there to consider a big tuition increase, and thousands of angry students turned out to protest. Police in riot gear looked on. In spite of all the commotion, the tuition hike passed, and NPR's Carrie Kahn joins us now from UCLA, where she's been covering today's protest. Carrie, we said it's a big tuition increase for the University of California. How big?
It is very big. It'll be over $2,500, and it starts this academic year. It kicks in January, and then the bulk of it is next fall. So it's a big hike for students. It's going to be about 32%, but the UC Regents today said they had no other options. They are running out of money. Here's UC President Mark Udoff.
We don't have any money. You don't have any money. And all the demonstrations and all the talking, they're words. This balances the budget, and it stops the bleeding, and it maintains the quality for our students.
Now, when he says when you don't have any money, he's talking about California's general financial problems?
Yes, and the financial problems seem to be getting worse. We just heard that there's a $21 billion budget deficit, which means that they're cutting even more funding to the UC system. The Regents also put in an application for a $900 million increase in funding for next year. They say if they don't get it, there'll have to be even more fee hikes, and they fear that they'll have to cut classes and reduce the incoming freshman class. So it's just a bad situation. UC President Mark Udoff said it is a lose-lose situation for students. If they don't pay the fee hikes now, they're just going to have less class offerings next year.
And these are fee hikes not just for UCLA, but for the entire UC system?
All 10 campuses, yes, they'll see an increase. And that means that an annual UC education will now be over $10,000 a year. And that doesn't include room, board, or books. That's just fees and tuition. And so, you know, in the last decade, that means a threefold increase. So it is a big hike.
Okay, thank you, Carrie.
You're welcome.
It's NPR's Carrie Kahn reporting from Los Angeles on today's big tuition hike for the University of California system.